It had fallen as flat for them as my plan to stop them, and they desisted naturally because there was nothing more to say. For 3 days, I am told, the story held the front pages, then it faded, as scandalous stories always do, leaving behind the debris and detritus for us to live with and overcome. If you were to ask if it made any difference to us being the target of bad publicity, then I would answer yes, it made a lot of difference and in various ways. On a purely practical level, one big disappointment was that the publisher declined any other books. 3 more books were actually published in hardcover by another publisher in Britain, but it was a smaller, lesser-known firm and there was not the same distribution. There were also translations in other languages, but not on the same scale as for The Third Eye. That, of course, meant less money, and money, distasteful as it may be, was the reason for writing, money needed to do the real work. The reading public at best are fickle, as any writer knows, but now the uncertainty of royalties was a worry, and Chen was not prepared to lecture or appear in public to augment his income as most writers are forced to do. The agent, Cecil Banks, continued to represent Chen until he retired from the firm, and that was a comfort. As well, it made a difference to the fan mail, which perhaps was a good thing. Now the people who wrote were more serious and therefore not swayed by any bad publicity, but there were far fewer letters than before, although still enough to keep us busy. It was an indication of how powerful the media is in controlling mass thought. It must be true, it was in the paper, People WLL say. Often nothing is further from the truth than that which the press are capable of cleverly indicating to a gullible public. The major difference, however, was within Chen himself. He became more defensive, even more loath to see people. He had been severely injured. In the long haul, that is, over the years, it may even have impaired his psychic ability, although this was not apparent for a long, long time. He had always been unable to tolerate superficial sensation seekers, but previously at least he had been civil. Now it seemed he had to be offensive sometimes to keep them away. This was unfortunate because it earned him a poor reputation in certain circles, and it was an unfair and undeserved reputation. Then there was the controversy over who he was. Let me explain how the plumber story originated. Rab's first husband must have been an interesting man, although I formed the opinion that he was weak in certain ways. I hasten to say that I could be mistaken in that assessment. I never met him, he had long since departed. My understanding was that his father owned a plumbing business in Devonshire, but I doubt very much that either he or his son would have known how to fix the dozens of things that plumbers fix. They left that to their employees. He seems, this first husband, to have been a bit of a misfit. Again, I am guessing because we discussed him very infrequently, but he had a much greater than usual interest in esoteric and metaphysical matters. He was, or so I believe, working with photography to make the aura visible on film, or to relay to the astral, but was having no success and may not even have known consciously why he was doing it or exactly what he was doing. He obviously knew there was something he was supposed to be doing, but was not clear what it was. Unless you are psychic and understand the ability, there is often confusion just like a scrambled telephone line. You are bugged and unhappy all the time because you cannot get through the veil to your overself and see things clearly, yet you know there is something you should be doing, but what it is, well, that part is unclear. He was depressed and ready to give up. So Chen took his place and allowed him to leave, allowed his karma to be cleared. Chen took his space, the work had to be done. That is really all there was to it. We had long discussions about Chen writing a book describing this and explaining the taking over of another body, transmigration, as it is called. He felt it was necessary to tell it as it was. Rab, on the other hand, was opposed to him writing anything of the sort. She expostulated that he would never be believed, the public would think he was completely mad, it just was not the kind of thing you tried to explain to people who were esoterically unaware. I had such faith in Chen that I agreed with him. I reasoned that even if he was not generally believed at that time, he may well be vindicated in the future, and I still believe that to be the case. His way of telling a story was gripping, and could be read by anyone. What the reader got out of it was up to him or her. You could read it as a fantastic story today, tomorrow you might read it as a true and vital account. The upshot was that he wrote about his experiences after he left Tibet, he wrote about the taking over of another body, and he wrote it in his own inimitable way, the sort of book that one cannot put down because it grabs you and carries you along like a thriller. Whether or not you believe it, you still are compelled to read it. But I have always maintained that, while all his books were bestsellers, and he wrote 21 at least, only in one, The Third Eye, did he put his heart because after that his heart was broken. That was really what happened as a result of the lies and insinuations about him. It broke his heart, but not his invincible spirit. He continued in face of it all. Even now, so long after, theories abound about who Lobsang Rangpa really was. Some say the books were written by a group of university graduates, others that he was transcribing dictation from the other side, and yet others that he was a psychic describing a past life. But the truth is just as he gave it. He may have jazzed it up a bit to make it more readable. But all writers do that. There is nothing to be gained in writing a great work so dull that no one gets beyond the first chapter then, bored to tears, relegates it to the top shelf where it stays forever, unread. We continued our lives in Ireland for a while. If the locals held anything against us, they kept it hidden. The Irish have known so much trouble that they do their best to avoid any more and will appear friendly, and in fact will be genuinely friendly, because they want things to turn out well. Time was running out, however, and we all knew that before long we would be up and away. Chen disliked putting down roots. He needed to be moving and gaining fresh experiences. The thing that finally got us mobilized was that Norton decided to buy the little stone house on the cliff. Our landlord lived in Sutton Cross and he had had the house up for sale for some time, but with no takers, that is, until good old Norton came along with his disruptive way of doing things. It is hard to know what his motives were, whether he was truly altruistic and wanted to assist Chen by giving him a rent-free house, or whether he believed that in doing so it would give him power over the situation. As I had no great goodwill towards poor Norton, I am inclined to believe the latter. Whatever the truth was, Chen announced that if Norton wanted the house, well and good, but he was not staying there anyway. So that was the end of it, and the end of our contact with Norton, who took offense, saw Chen as ungrateful and exited our lives with no tears on our part, and possibly only temper tantrums on his. North America was our next goal, really the USA, but that was thwarted because Chen had TB scars on his lungs, so was unacceptable for immigration to the United States. Canada seemed the obvious choice, and in fact the only other possibility, and we began the long business of filling in papers, undergoing medical examinations, etc. Before we left, I wanted to see Lady Shane to say goodbye. She was a person I liked and admired, and I knew she was ill. I went over to the castle one afternoon, and found her lying in her bed, almost a mythical figure. The four-poster was huge, the curtains hung frayed and falling to bits, and there was a bedstool placed beside the bed. It was too high to climb into otherwise. The long, narrow windows looked out over what had been parkland, and still was in a sense, and the sun fell in long shafts on the counterpane. Ping lay at her feet, guarding his beloved mistress. Only he and Maggie were there to take care of her in what we both knew was her last illness. She had refused hospital, and managed with the frequent visits of the doctor and the priest. Her once glowing cheeks were yellowed, the skin pulled tight, her eyes sunken. I had no wish to prolong my visit, it was too tiring for her and too painful for me, but before I left she said, "Your life won't be easy, you know, it never is with a genius, but it will be worth it." I felt a kinship and an understanding with her such as I seldom find with other people. Although our lives had touched briefly, I felt we had known each other in many, many lives before, and I think we both knew our paths would cross again. That same day in the evening when I arrived home, Rab handed me a letter. It was from Marty and it delighted me to hear from her. I came across her note only the other day amongst my papers. Dear Madam, I am taking the liberty of writing to you to tell you that my niece was very happy with the clothes you said I was to take from your wardrobe. I hope I did right in taking the beautiful red satin you wore for your presentation. She is going to a wedding at Southend-on-Sea and will look beautiful in it, quite a lady. I took it up a little and let out the side seams and it fits her very nicely. I often say a little prayer for you, Madam. God will take care of you. Respectfully yours, Margaret Martin. And so ended another chapter. Chapter 7. Windsor, Canada. The airport, 2 days before Christmas, 1959. It was a modest-sized airport, not intended to take large crowds, but this day it was jammed with people, people loaded with luggage and parcels wrapped in bright shiny paper, people stressed and irritable. The business of Christmas was getting them down, exhausting them. The counter attendant at the buffet was almost at the end of her shift for the day. She had had enough, she could hardly wait to get out of the place and be on her way home. Then, just as I'm about to leave, this woman comes along and asks for 3 cups of tea, the counter attendant told her husband later that evening. English, looks real done in, but with this voice like she thinks she's the queen, or something. Well, I told her to help herself. She looks confused, like she doesn't know what I'm talking about, so I get the hot water from the urn for her in the cups. No, she says, real firm, I'd like tea, please, not water. Tea bags right there, I tell her, pointing to them. Tea bags. She says, what's that? I'd like tea, not bags. Imagine. Gee. Didn't even know what tea bags were. Don't know what kind of immigrants we're getting these days, sure makes you wonder. Her husband turned up the volume on the television. He wasn't interested in the vagaries of oddballs. We had been delayed at New York. The small plane sat on the tarmac for at least an hour before it got clearance. Worst time of year to travel, the pilot had said. Poor weather conditions, too many travelers, extra planes put on, worst time of year. He was not too happy himself at the thought of taking 3 adults and 2 cats to Canada, too much water to fly over for one thing, and the wrong time of year. He would have preferred to be at home instead of battling with the hassle of Christmas. Never mind, it was money in the bank. At Windsor the formalities seemed to take forever. Eventually, we were through, we were labeled legally landed immigrants to this land of the free, the new world, Canada. It was stamped on our passports, landed immigrant, so it had to be right, that was what we were. But where was the friend who was meeting us? He had given up and gone home, that seemed obvious. I found the telephones, and after a struggle with the one I had lined up for, having it refuse to do what I wanted and insisting on spitting back the coins I kept putting in, or, alternatively, gobbling up others without putting me through, I reached the friend. His name was Paul. He was an old friend of the Rampers from London days, well before I knew them. He must have been sitting right beside the telephone, because he answered immediately. Okay, I'll be there in 30 minutes, he said with assurance. Just sit tight. Let's have a cup of tea while we wait, Chen suggested. I went to get it but it was disgusting. All you could say for it was that it was warm and wet and a time killer. Rab was much better at doing those kind of things, better able to handle new things than I was, but she was occupied pacifying the cats. And the tea would not have tasted any better even if she had got it instead of me. It would still have been warm water with a bag of dust-like teeth thrown in. That must be how they make it in Canada, I thought. Paul had done his best, and found a house he thought suitable for us all. It was outside Windsor at a place called Tecumseh, right on a lake, Lake St. Clair, opposite Grosse Pointe where the wealthy of Detroit lived. The lake seemed immense, just one huge stretch of frozen water at that time of year, but it was as nothing compared to the Great Lakes, Erie, Huron, Superior, Ontario and Michigan, which are like inland seas connected to each other. We stayed there, in Tecumseh, in the snow and ice for a couple of months. Then we moved to Windsor, where we rented a standard riverfront house, right opposite Detroit and not too far from the tunnel under the river. It was near the Ambassador Bridge, too, so we had a choice of over or under the water whenever we went to Detroit for camera equipment, or other needs. Being on the water and close to a major US city were important for Chen. He was in the midst of activity and movement, world progress. That seemed to be what he needed for his work. Countries, just like people, come under astrological influences. Canada is a Cancer country, the United States of America is Gemini. In general, Americans tend to be talkative, they like change, adore gadgets, are always on the go and like getting ahead. Canadians, on the other hand, and, again, only in general, are quieter, modest, home and family lovers, keepers of the peace at all costs because the country is ruled by Cancer. By rights, Canada should be a good place for me because my own birth sign is Cancer, but it just simply was not what I expected, or at least the places we lived in were not. One could argue that we were always close to the US border and that certainly may have had a bearing on it. If we had lived in more remote parts, it may have been different, but my ideas of what the country was like were based, as with Ireland, on childhood concepts gained from writers like Grey Owl and John Buchan. Where were the log cabins? Where was the grandiose geography, the mountains, prairies, forests, rivers and glaciers? And where were the wild animals and the Red Indians, the true inhabitants of this country? Nowhere to be seen anywhere where we lived. I longed for the untamed parts of this immense country and instead saw only ribbon development with vulgar hoardings advertising, advertising, advertising. Everything was money, everything was new and glittering and uncomfortable for me. Nothing was more than skin deep, there was no substance, or that was how it struck me, and I withdrew into my shell. It was different for the others, I think. Or maybe they were just more adaptable than I was. Certainly neither of them were Cancer crabs as I am. Chen was Aries, and Rab on the cusp of Gemini and Taurus. We stayed in Ontario for around 5 years, making many moves but always close to the water. When I look at the colors for that time, the colors in my magic painting, they are insipid, dull and uninteresting. Chen continued his life much as it was before. Writing, dealing with letters, keeping up with scientific and world affairs. He never intended to be a writer, but that was what he was known as because that is how he made a living, although writing is actually quite a precarious way of making a living. You might put a huge effort into your writing only to find the book or article does not sell. Perhaps the publisher is at fault, perhaps the timing is wrong, perhaps the public just do not like or understand it. Again, the reviewers may not like you, and their opinion exercises great influence over the public. When it became time for a paperback firm to publish The Third Eye, it was taken by a young company with an editor who proved to be not only interested in Chen's work and to believe in him, but was also invariably agreeable. None of us ever met him, but we wrote hundreds of letters to him, as he to Chen. I say we because we worked as a team. This paperback firm eventually became the principal publisher, and after the first 4 books nothing was ever printed in hardback again. Chen felt a certain loyalty to the firm and the publisher, and stayed with them until the end. And the books sold. The sad part is that the cheap paper used in those books disintegrates over time. Now, at the time of writing, I am unable to even open one without experiencing breathing difficulties caused by the chemicals in the paper. Not only that, they are difficult to read because of the yellowing of the paper and the poor print. The hardcover books, on the other hand, are almost as good as new, and completely readable. Chen routinely discussed things with both Rab and myself. I typed everything from his dictation, and Rab checked it. His ability to include us all always in everything was what kept us together, and gave great strength and stability. We were tightly bound and mixed very little with others. Occasionally I might get my hair done, for instance, and when that happened he preferred not to see me for a few hours afterwards. The aura of the hairdresser lingered around my head or was mixed with my own colors, which he found distressing. I just don't want to know about that fellow, he would say. He was so accustomed to both of us, Rab and me, that he was able to disregard, or at least accept, our changing colors. But he definitely preferred we did not mix with outsiders other than on a superficial level. This was no hardship to me. I contented myself by taking up painting, needlepoint, reading a lot, and making a thorough and enjoyable study of antiques, rugs, paintings, furniture, silver, all things I loved to experience and later on to own. In the world today we are supposed to mix and be sociable. Children have it drummed into them from their earliest days that they need to be one of the crowd, but in fact one can gain far more from remaining solitary. I believe that quietude and self-reliance are not sufficiently valued by the majority. Throughout the years I lived with Chen, I was able to indulge that rare state of solitude, and it is significant that not once did I visit a doctor. I was never ill, not even with the common cold. Memories are funny things, and it seems odd that my most outstanding memory of Windsor was the monkey. You would think all my attention was focused on the work we were doing together, Chen, Rab and I, and to a great extent it was, but that was every day and ongoing. The monkey was different. I used to walk quite a lot when it was not too hot or too cold, which admittedly was limiting. By this time, however, I was getting used to shedding clothes like a dog shedding its coat in summer, and piling clothes on in winter, which tended to extend the yearly walking period, and on my walks I got to know Windsor well. I always stopped at one particular pet shop just to look in the window, and it was on one of those stops that I saw the monkey. He was sitting in a cramped cage, and a more dejected looking monkey you never saw. I was compelled to enter the shop and was immediately struck by that smell peculiar to a pet shop selling livestock only for profit, a smell made up of wet sawdust, unclean animals and food left for too long in the cages. I inquired the price of the monkey. Oh yes, poor little fellow, needs a good home, said the proprietor. Came from Central America. Needs a good home, he repeated, at the same time naming a price. I went outside again to take a good look at the poor little fellow, and he gazed back at me with huge eyes set in a tiny head. Then he covered his head with two long-fingered hands as if he were in the throes of intense misery. He was so human, he was so sad. My heart went out to him. Right, I'll take him, I said as I came back in, and the minute the words were out of my mouth I knew it was a mistake. Nevertheless, I thought, what if the monkey had heard and knew what I had said? I had to take him now. Quick as a flash, the shopkeeper wrote out the bill and eased the cage out of the window. He had no intention of letting me change my mind. I looked at my purchase again, and convinced myself I was right to take him after all. How could I leave this small, defenseless creature there in such abject suffering and misery? I had to take him. He was mine come hell or high water. Carrying the cage along the streets was eventful. If people did not stop to look, they wanted to, and only a form of manners stopped them. As I neared home I was starting to get nervous. I had no problem with Chen's acceptance of the monkey, but what was Rab going to say? I could only imagine. Whenever I returned home from my walks she was invariably the first one I saw. She would be sitting in the living room through which one had to pass to get to the rest of the house. Her habit was not to greet one, a mere nod was the best you could hope for, but today was different. She took one look at the cage. What on earth is that? She snapped. It's a monkey. I bought him. You what? Incredulous. I said, I bought him. Didn't you hear? I wasn't going to let her bully me, I was determined to keep the monkey. The poor little fellow. He needed a good home, the pet shop man said so. What about the cats? Didn't you think of them before you did such a daft thing as buy a monkey? They're nasty little creatures, it'll make life a misery for the cats. Look Rab, I can't have a dog because of the cats, and now you're saying I can't have a monkey. Well, I'm going to have him. The cats will just have to get used to him. He needs a good home. I was getting more and more protective of the monkey and determined to stand my ground. You're hopeless, Sheila. I don't know what Chen's going to say. She did a huge stage sign shoulder shrug. It might have been a monster in the cage instead of a poor, innocent little monkey. Chen's room was upstairs. It had a window looking out over the river from which he could watch shipping passing through the lakes with their cargo. The lakers were distinct from ocean-going vessels, flat-bottomed, but there were also ocean-going ships which had come from the Atlantic through the St. Lawrence Seaway in Quebec. I went upstairs with the monkey in his cage and found Chen sitting cross-legged on his bed, busy carving a piece of lignum vitae, a wonderful old piece, hard and greenish, that he was making into a pendant. He looked up as I approached. "Hello, Buttercup. You've got a spider monkey." I knew he was familiar with monkeys from India, but I had fancied this was a little different, but perhaps not. At least he knew it was a spider monkey. They can be naughty little devils, you know. Woolly monkeys are more placid, but then they're bigger. He got up to take a better look at the little creature. "It doesn't look very well. Where did you get it?" He was not in the least perturbed. The monkey was still cramped up and kept covering his head with his hands. He looked the picture of misery. "Well, you see, Chen, it was in a horrid pet shop. I had to rescue it. I'm sorry, I hope it'll be all right with the cats." I was almost in tears, afraid he might tell me to take it back, having visions of camping out on the riverbank with the monkey in tow. "Of course you had to get it, you couldn't leave it there. It probably needs something to eat, a piece of banana perhaps. I expect it came from Brussels or somewhere. Trouble is, they catch them very cruelly, sometimes they never recover mentally. Anyway, let's give it a try." Kiwi had left her safe place and taken cover under the bed. Fifi was out of the way in Rab's room. He considered the situation for a minute then said, "I know, we'll let it out on the sun porch. It can't get away there." Obviously he was not going to assume it was a meek little thing ready for a petting. We took the cage out to the sun porch, which was a sort of addition to his bedroom, faced west and got lots of warmth and light. The windows, as all windows in Ontario, had screens in an attempt to keep mosquitoes and other noxious insects away, so we were able to open the windows without fear of the monkey getting out and creating havoc on the rooftops. We put the cage down, and I opened the door. Instantly the little thing leapt out screaming and cursing, running around the walls almost at ceiling height, grabbing anything he could, swinging with those amazing long arms. He was utterly wild and furious, terrifying in his rage and frustration. Even Chen was surprised at the power of his fury and his energy. "We'd better leave him and see if he settles down. Can you get out of the door without letting him out and get him something to eat and drink?" he asked. Gingerly I made my escape when the monkey was at the other end of the sun porch, and came back with carrots, nuts and banana, and a bowl of water. Rab had been alerted by all the screaming, and watched in disbelief. She actually loved animals, but a monkey was rather beyond her, mainly because of her concern for the cats. "You can't possibly keep that creature," she said with her customary and irritating common sense. "It's going to upset the cats, not to mention Chen." "Well, Chen isn't upset. The poor little fellow needs a good home," I told her, inanely repeating the pet shop man's words. "I wish you'd just shut up, Rab." She was not pleased, and was obviously going to be an adversary. "We're going to call him July," I told her, as if having a name made him a reality and a fixture in our household. "That's not what I'd call him," she said flatly. "He's a horror." Over the next few weeks we tried everything we could think of to accommodate the monkey. We had a carpenter build a very large cage in the sun porch, complete with branches for him to swing on, a sleeping shelf, a feeding area, the works. He still hated us. He hated us intensely and made his hatred known. Whenever I tried to pick him up he bit and screeched. At the crack of dawn he started chattering and screaming. In a way, his agility and wildness was exhilarating, but his hatred was different because it was so destructive. I had always had pets, everything from horses, to dogs, cats, rabbits, fish, birds, tortoises, So I was no stranger to them, but over the weeks I was forced to admit that the monkey, as Rab had predicted, would have to go. There was no likelihood that he was going to subject himself to domesticity, and besides his distrust of humans was all-consuming.